So for tonight, so this is what, Wednesday, December 9th, right, 2009. And as we often do, we start with a question or a comment about meditation or anything. So anyone have a question or comment? It's fine. It's great. Okay, great. Well, then, you ready to jump in? So we've been exploring relationships in here for a year. Relationships both as a setting in which it's important to grapple with the causes of suffering and the causes that take us to the end of suffering. And also, we've been exploring relationships as a resource and refuge in practice itself. So the two go together. And as we move toward the end of the year, I thought there was no way in the world we could avoid the topic of sexuality. And it's interesting that it hasn't been particularly brought up, but I thought I wouldn't be doing my job here if I didn't bell the cat, as the fairy tale has it, and address that subject. So the last time we met, I searched for my mug here, started exploring the traditional Dharma teachings, at least as we can best guess them, from the Buddha, related to sexuality, which basically have to do with the third of the five precepts, which is to not harm oneself or others through sexuality. Most of the languaging that's been handed down to us over the centuries that is attributed to the Buddha himself is basically boils down to infidelity. Don't do infidelity, he says. Not on moralistic grounds, but rather on grounds that it leads to suffering for oneself and other people. That's kind of very short and sweet. And yet if you think about it, there's a lot more to sexuality and there's a lot more to harm and happiness related to sexuality than simply, you know, don't cheat, right? And so I thought, well, let's explore this a bit. Let's open up to some additional potential subjects or aspects of sexuality last week related to harming. And so I brought up three, which we talked about some, and they formed the basis for, you know, if you wanted to do any homework out of here, you could do that. You could, you know, reflect on them and so forth. And the three that I brought up additionally were, one, the ways in which fixating on some particular person or sensation or visual stimulus can lead to suffering, right? I think pornography is a great example of fixation on a particular visual stimulus, particularly for men. And there are other forms of fixation on a particular form, you know, and I think there's a lot of suffering that comes from that. A second source of suffering is shame. We definitely talked about that last week, didn't we? You know, how many of us have grown up in kind of shame-based cultures related to sexuality and have, in the phrase from diversity work, internalized the oppression. We've taken it into ourselves and been, you know, harsh with ourselves related to sexuality and shaming about it. And then the third kind of harm is to block the flow. If you think of it, sexuality, or broadly defined erotic energy, is a flow within oneself and between ourselves, between us and others. And by blocking that flow, we tend to create suffering, suffering for ourselves and suffering for other people. So we talked about that, right? And then, you know, I encourage people to kind of go out and, if you wanted, be fruitful and multiply. No, I didn't actually say that, but I could have. It would have been a good line, wouldn't it? You know, but to do the explore the antithesis or explore the opposite, if you will. In other words, rather than fixating, open out, right? Rather than shame, bless. Rather than constrict, flow. So it was open, bless, and flow. Those were kind of the three watchwords as an alternative way to approach eros, broadly defined, both within the body and between oneself and others, both, you know, highly sexualized and also at the other end of the spectrum, more diffuse. So that was the suggestion. So before I go on to the next kind of notion I have tonight. Does anyone have any comment on anything I've said so far, either just right here and now, or any reflection from last week or any practice you did? I was talking with my wife over that this subject is one where it's very interesting. You have to make it kind of safe to talk about it, right? Yet I think it's possible to talk about it in a way, particularly in terms of one's own, just what happens in the mind. So, any comment? Yeah, for Tarnay, then. Yeah, Tarnay.
I wonder why the Buddha made it so clear-cut that monastics were to be celibate. That was just off-limits. It's just so potentially entangling that that one's just not going to be included.
You're saying you wonder why... Why the Buddha said in monastic life, nuns as well as monks, why sexual activity, including masturbation, is just it's in the Vinaya, the monastic code, it's proscribed, right? And do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, my thought is that it's just so complicated that the entanglements that ensue are just fraught with samsara and dukkha, and you need to avoid them.
Right.
If you're going to be a monastic.
Yeah.
And so that makes me wonder, a layperson, being involved in those activities, just opens up a whole world of difficulties.
That's a provocative view. Anybody have comments on that? Yeah, Ozzy.
I guess I would say that the entanglements that ensue from one are, to some degree, balanced by the entanglements that ensue from the other, whether the choice is to be celibate or to not be celibate. I mean, either path has its own entanglements, in a sense. The choice to be celibate, I think, is one that I think has probably some psychological implications and so forth, which are probably significant. So I guess either way, you've kind of got some things that you're going to have to deal with, right? It's not as though one may have entanglements and the other is scot-free.
Okay, yeah, it's a big topic, yeah.
The issue of celibacy or not seems to me a much different issue than infidelity, and it's just a whole different kind of animal.
Yeah.
I found the talk last week on the dukkha of infidelity really helpful and expansive of my whole awareness of suffering in general. And the context that you put infidelity or inappropriate behavior as suffering was a huge eye-opener for me.
Mm.
And my partner Rita and I talked about it, and it was big. What it did was, this week I had a different kind of suffering. I got wrapped up in football dukkha. But the talk on sexuality last week and the suffering there really helped me be aware of my football dukkha. I mean, I was doing web searches on news about the BCS picks when there was no news anymore. I mean, the thing had happened.
Yeah.
And I was searching for more and more news. I was spending a couple hours a day doing it.
That's a fixation.
It's a fixation.
It's an example of suffering, the fixation.
No different than, like, looking at pornography, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm, that's really good.
That my whole awareness mm-hmm. really grew.
Yeah, that's great.
Of suffering in general.
Yeah. And I'll just say that at our next meeting, I really hope to get into a topic that I think is at the center of what Tarne is bringing up, and as well what Ozzie was saying, which is how to participate with sensual pleasure without getting caught by it. And I think the Buddha, who basically said he teaches one thing, suffering in its end, I mean, he basically wasn't saying everybody should become a monastic, but he was saying that if you want to dedicate your life to awakening and being liberated from suffering, and you're going to do it in a full-on way, well, to him, duh, obviously, you would renounce sexuality as a distraction and a, you know, just sort of a complication. And I think, so therefore, those of us that haven't renounced it yet have a genuine and sincere interest in pretty significant progress on the path of awakening in this lifetime, then we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's going on in our engagement with the pleasures of the senses? Because the way the brain works is very mechanistic at a basic level. If it's sweet, it wants it, right? If it's rewarding, it wants it. Even kind of twisted rewards, like getting exhausted playing a video game, you know, or at a work in the slot machine at Vegas, or spending 2 hours a day, you know, looking for BCS information with your eyes blurring out of your head, right? Or getting obsessed with finishing all your emails before you go to bed at night. You know, whatever your obsession or fixation is. Isn't that the art? The art is to, if we're going to live the life of the senses, to do it with really, really penetrating intelligence if we have a genuine interest in awakening. Right? How to do that. So I have some thoughts about that, and I want to defer them to next week because I have some thoughts about what I consider more preparatory for that that I hope to get into this week. So if it's okay, I'd like to defer the whole discussion of celibacy, pros and cons, you know, till next week, if that's okay. All right. So anything else about this notion of harming yourself? Isn't it interesting that so much of the construction of the precept is, you know, don't, you know, basically don't be unfaithful, essentially. And that's so much constructed as harming others. But what about the ways that we harm ourselves through the way we participate with sexuality, broadly defined? Anybody else have any more thoughts about that? Great. Linda.
I just have a comment, and I think I had the same comment a while ago when we were talking about sexuality, which is sexuality is a path to the transcendent or to the sacred. And when there's a context of harming and suffering, and we can lose that sense of senses and sensuality and sexuality being access to an experience that's just much larger and dissolving of self. And so it just somehow seems important to keep that on the radar also. It really can be a path, not just a pleasure and a reward, but to the sacred and to deep meaning.
Okay.
Not that lost.
Okay, great. So, other thoughts or comments about, you know, expanding the notion of not harming oneself through self-shaming or, you know, fixating or, you know, constricting?
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to think of how to put it. It seems to me that a lot of, and we talked a little bit about this last week, a lot of the kind of self-contempt, self-loathing, that sort of dynamic that occurs as a result of upbringing in, you know, whatever, hyper-religious or whatever. I think we had Catholics and Southern Baptists represented last week. A lot of that is out of the person's control, springs from the unconscious, and therefore simply saying, you know, don't do this because it's self-harming doesn't cut it. You know, so it's almost like, you know, it seems like a straightforward instruction in this case is insufficient. It doesn't take into account the fact that the unconscious can be the generator of those kinds of self-harming mm-hmm. behaviors, and that's really outside of control. Of course, awareness leads one then presumably to being able to see that, but it seems like an awfully complicated process and not kind of taken account of in a simple step, kind of, sure, you just do this and it'll be fine.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of people are in the news these days have gotten into extraordinary trouble, for a few moments, for a few hours of pleasure, right?
Oh, I thought it was just 20 seconds. Could you give us your impression? What was the highlight of the year, I think, last year?
Well, I've had some friends who are lesbian, and they talk about men who think with their little head instead of their big one. So, yeah. Did you want to say something? I hope.
You have to look at it in the context of the times, in the context of the place, monastic versus that, and particularly historical times. Victorian times, one might engage in a lot more suffering, or what is it called, self-harming thoughts, because they were trying to align or misalign themselves with the mores of the times. But the 60s, it might be a different. So, and then who knows when the Buddhists, why were those such strict laws? They would have to have been related to survival and evolution. I'm sure that that's, in terms of history, that survival of the fit and go. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. Because history is long, I could go for a long time.
Great. One or two more, then I want to do a little exercise with you, if you're willing, internally, and then we can talk more about it. Yeah.
I just think this is such a huge subject, and it's so thought-provoking. I guess I was a little frustrated last week because we just touched on it, and I got that set.
Oh, no.
Because, I just keep on coming up with the cultural stuff. I'm wondering if I could go back in time, or if I grew up in Africa or India or Thailand, which is Thailand itself being basically a Buddhist country and having a lot of sexual issues there. And it's just, it's such a basic thing to like. It's the creation of life. And, and it's pleasure, and it's pain. And it's so complicated. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole issues of, like celibacy, say, in priesthood, and we all know where the problems of that, and I'm sure it's true in monastic situations, too. Mm-hmm. And I can't get to that from Buddhist can have sex.
Some do, some don't. The Dalai Lama is a monk, but
yeah,
Sokni Rinpoche has one or more children. Yeah.
So it's just, I have no answers to anything. It's just, you wonder about times, you wonder about cultures, and it is, sort of like the vibration and things that you're taught, and look at the media right now, a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Intense,
the
interest in.
Yeah. Yeah, if you think about it, one of the eight elements of the Eightfold Path, of course, is wise mindfulness. And the root of the word mindfulness, sati in Pali, is recollection. And what strikes me a lot about any kind of fixation, whether it's to the BCS scores or to sexuality, is that, or potentially sexuality, it's when we lose recollectedness, when we're carried away. And as soon as we're carried away and we've lost that capacity to be recollected, to be actually mindful of anything, whatever it is, whether it's our emails or eating sugar or drinking or smoking or sexing, whatever that is, as soon as we do that, we're setting ourselves up for harms. Right. And I think the nature of, it is interesting that, I mean, the Vinaya is this long list of don'ts, basically, that are pretty detailed and grew over time. And a lot of them basically are prompts for coming back to recollectedness. Right. So it's interesting to ask ourselves, when do we lose recollectedness? When do you lose sati? Right. When do you lose it in terms of activities and sensual experiences? You know, it doesn't mean, you know what I mean by recollectedness? You're aware. There's a recollectedness. It comes from the word remembering, sati does. And so I think with the Buddha's practical teaching, and then of course, as in everything, see for yourself, but I think his practical teaching is, lose recollectedness, yellow flag for sure. Yeah. Okay, yeah, great.
So then I wonder, are there instructions for mindful sexuality where you're not lost, you're not heedless, you're actually present and aware, and somehow that's part of the sexual experience, and the mindfulness and the awareness holds that? And wouldn't that be an amazing thing?
Mm-hmm.
I would write that list.
Yeah, well, you might have to write it, and because you're not going to find it in the Pali Canon or the Vinaya.
This is not a joke, but that 20 seconds that you so beautifully portrayed earlier, I think you do lose yourself for that time, don't you?
Well, that's the question. I think that's the question, you know.
And I think it's pretty good, too. I mean, just think how many people are in that position.
That's his wife, you know. For those of you who don't know. Yeah.
It's nice to think that there may be, you know, hundreds of millions of people who are experiencing it right now.
Yeah. That's right. Although, it's good to think about it. I mean, I think about Tiger Woods and, you know, just the incredible harm to himself. I mean, we were talking earlier, just to, you know, one of the more mundane ways of thinking about it is round numbers. I bet he's lost $500 million in endorsements lifetime, you know, in one way or another. And all the other kinds of self-harm he's done himself through this, and yet in the time he was doing it, and he was doing it a lot with a lot of people, apparently, it seemed like a good idea at the time, right? Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky sure seemed like a good idea at the time.
Boundless capacity for self-discipline.
Yeah, and again, loss of recollectedness. And I think it's interesting and useful to be humble and modest about one's capacity to be kind of, how can I put it, to admit the degree to which it can seem like a good idea at the time and yet be a really bad idea, you know? And I can think of two things for myself. One, I've in my wayward youth, I can think of one particular time where at the time it seemed like the smartest, best, most appropriate thing in the world. And then when it was over, I thought, oh my God, you know? And what was so interesting was how in the moment it was completely clear. It was just, of course, absolutely elevated, aloft, enchanted, inflated in the Jungian sense. It was just fabulous. And yet, later I realized I was just enchanted. You know, when, in other words, how are we enchanted by things? Because obviously so much of what's central to practice is disenchantment. Right, and that's, again, particularly what I want to explore next time. How does one allow life to flow through us, including life as a practice, as Linda said so beautifully, that draws us to the sacred, you know, in a sense of oneness with all beings and loving care for them. How do we do that without getting enchanted, without losing our way, right? That's isn't that all right? Yeah, Larry.
I should have phrased this, but isn't it very human to seek these experiences? And by these experiences, I mean an altered state, and also potentially harmful. Like, why in the world would anybody ever go on a roller coaster, right? Why do we do that? You know, I mean, I love them, but why? Why do we do it? Why do we watch something that is very dramatic and makes us intensely sad against such compassion for those fictional characters, or watch a comic making fun of something that maybe we have a guilty pleasure that shouldn't be made fun of, and it's hysterical, you know? And just all kinds of experiences where we lose ourselves, and we even have a word, catharsis, which supposedly is a good thing, right, for watching a dramatic, you know, entertainment. So sex and sexuality and peak experiences of union with someone, you know, particularly if you love, you know, much less, you know, I mean, well, anyway, you get the point. I don't know what is that about humans that we don't really recollect ourselves in a lot of these peak experiences, right? And of course, there are drug-induced experiences and such as well.
Yeah. Well, one, you know, again, I want to open it up to people and Trisha just a second, but partly, and I don't have a final answer for this. I have a pretty strong sense of some major guidelines and general principles that are sort of best odds strategies, if you will. One thing I think about peak experiences is, to me, there is a place for them, and they remind me of Gurdjieff's line about psychedelics, that they're like a telescope. They show you what's possible for a time, but then you've got to get there on your own. So you stabilize, right? You stabilize that. Where the Tibetan Buddha saying, moments of enlightenment, many times a day, right? And you start stringing them together, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think sexuality is great because it's a petri dish, you know, of a lot of tendencies of mind. And one of the very interesting things that happens is that, and this is what you probably have noticed this in meditation. I'll use that as an example because I was reflecting on that in my own setting, where you go through a period of time where you have this sort of wide open, spacious awareness, right? This kind of panoramic view. And the next thing you know, somehow you've been thinking about something fairly mundane, like, you know, the different donuts they have at the deli across the street. And in that moment, when you're caught in that little movie, right, or your plan for the later on, or this conversation you're having with this person, or this just sort of visual that's running through your head, when you're in that movie, what's the nature of that experience? Doesn't it seem in the moment that it's very real and it's stabilized, right? So it seems like an entity, and it seems permanent in that moment. And in that moment, you're enchanted. Because that's not the way life is. That's the fundamental truth of the Dharma, the three characteristics, right? That they're always changing and they interdependently arise. Okay? And so in that moment, as soon as we're sucked in, and I think that's very much these medial networks in the brain that do that, they just draw us in to fixate us on something, because that's how you survive. You know, you fixate on it, you hold it in place, the mind, the brain wants to hold it in place, and then we kind of focus on rewards related to it or punishments related to it, so we know what to do about it. It's natural, doesn't it? Isn't it interesting how hard it is to sustain that open field, spacious awareness without getting routinely sucked in to these little mini-movies that have a particular quality of being loss of recollection. There's no recollection when we're sucked in. And I think the larger point is how to explore intense experiences, right? And that's where I think Linda's comments, you know, one of the many ways it's really a wonderful comment, is that because they're so intense and they're so compelling, they're fantastic training. You know, you want to learn how to really ski? Go down a black diamond slope. You know, the skiers going down the bunny slopes, you can be a horrible skier like me and make it down a bunny slope. But if you're going to go down a black diamond slope, you got to learn how to ski pretty well. You want to learn how to practice, you know, practice with a chocolate truffle for 10 minutes dissolving in your mouth. You know, practice with those 20 seconds or even longer. you know, without losing recollectedness, you know, or eye contact maybe, you know, during that entire time. I mean, isn't that interesting? So what do you think of that? Did you want to rush in where angels fear to tread or more? I think we're going to just talk about this tonight. I don't think I'm going to do these little exercises.
It seems to me that sexuality is a supremely conscious act of loving kindness and giving.
And what?
Giving.
Uh-huh. Or you're just saying it can be that, or is innately that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's a big difference to say it can be, and
yeah.
Well, maybe it isn't for Tiger Woods. No, I think of him more as taking instead of giving. But
yeah, it's very nice.
Well, it seems to me that the whole basis of tantric sexual practices is what you were talking about. A focus on the giving and the connecting, really more than the physical acts. That's in my little study of it, that's what I take away.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Broader question around passion. What is the Buddhist teachings on passion? Like pursuing your own passions, which can be great creations and gifts to the world, and being and it's goal-oriented, making things better as here and now. But specifically passions.
So great question, and a couple things about it, I think. And I don't propose this as a complete answer, but one, it's very clear that he really emphasized the place of passion in practice. Like these four recurring words you see again and again and again in all kinds of suttas about how we should be as practitioners are ardent. That's the first word. Ardent, which means passionate, means heartfelt, means enthusiastic. It doesn't mean all dried up. The root of the word enthusiasm is God within, you know, and Deus within, and so enthusiasm. So ardent, and then diligent, resolute, and mindful. Those happen again and again. Also, you see that in the factors of awakening, bliss is one of them. And intense tranquility is another one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Or the jhana factors, deep states of absorption, two of the five are bliss and joy. So that's pretty passionate. It's also said that in his own path, where he talks very directly about his own process, it's a famous passage in there, kind of at the nadir, his own dark night of the soul, in effect. It wasn't in a transcendental sense of separation from God, dark night of the soul, but kind of his own nadir when he was at the end of his own ascetic practices. He recalled being a young boy sitting in an orchard while there was some festival in his family going on and dropping into a bliss state. And that bliss state reminded him, and there's some lovely language. I looked at that, to paraphrase, I could fish it out if we wanted to, but I looked at that experience and I asked myself, did that lead to harm? And it did not lead to harm. That experience did not lead to harm. It did not even promote clinging. I think that's another very interesting thing. What kind of sexuality or what kind of oral pleasure or any kind of other pleasure can we engage that doesn't lead to clinging? It's very interesting that people are generally not addicted to psychedelics, if you think about it. Some people get really into it, but you know, it's interesting. What form of intense sexual pleasure or what form of bliss does not promote clinging? Anyway, so now, in that framework, of course, it's passion for what? And he does speak approvingly for householders of people who take, who are dedicated to their craft, right? And that's a kind of passion. I have a hard time shoehorning this ancient teaching, which, as you said, has come out of a very different world, and trying to find justification within it for the way we in the West talk about passion, you know, as a value. And I think that, for me at least, what I go down to are basics, you know, the Dr. Phil question, how's it working for you? In other words, Are the things that we're passionate about, are we losing recollectedness? Are we getting enchanted by them, on the one hand? Or on the other hand, what I often see is people are terribly inhibited based on shame, classically, and a lack of an internal felt sense of self-compassion and an internalization of, you know, nurturance for themselves. They're not ardent. They don't go for it. Right? For every me, maybe I'm wrong, but for every person out there in the world who's like Tiger, right? Who's erred on the side of going way too far, I see 10 people who don't go far enough, my personal view, in terms of speaking from their heart, helping themselves soar as high as they can, so however high they soar, it won't because of a ceiling they're imposing on themselves. That's what I see. And I think one thing that, how can I put it, to turn it around, very often it's our attachments to looking good and to selfing that, and our own internalized oppression that blunt us from reaching and soaring and going as far as we possibly can. What do you think about that? Yeah, right there.
I have a question about the qualities of fidelity in relationship. I know it's, especially in the Bay Area, it's common to engage in, this combination of spirituality and polyamory, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I've
seen that up close and personal. Yeah.
And I personally have a hard time. I've certainly been in the dating world and tried dating different people around the same time until I decide on who I want to commit to, and even that was just really scattering. So to imagine being kind of intentionally polyamorous, and it just. I just have no idea how people can kind of stay, what that means for them as far as being, in fidelity. So when the Buddha spoke of fidelity in relationship, I presume that he was speaking to, was it a sutta with regards to lay people?
Yeah.
So, and did he say anything about monogamy specifically? Like, was that the type of fidelity that he was talking about?
They're all violations. I'll read it again. It's a short passage, and I searched for them, and it kind of boils down to this one. And then we'll move to a wrap here. Basically, where is this? Maybe it's right here. Here we go. So he's talking about unrighteous bodily conduct. So right off the top, the frame is, in the classic dharmic structure is acts of thought, word, and deed. All right? So it's in that structure that, isn't it interesting that he's talking about sexuality in terms of deed? So he doesn't get into a lot of the psychologizing. Like, for example, I've had clients who got deeply engaged in a kind of sexual fetish where they got very focused on a particular thing, whatever that might be, a body part, an object, a situation, and they ran the rewards on that, and it's an addiction. In other words, and you're training the brain. You're training the brain to make that how you get off, basically. So again, it's like a loose analogy would be giving candy to little kids, then apples no longer taste sweet because they're so flooded with that stimulation and they're fixed on it. So it is interesting that here he's just talking about the body. But what he says in a nutshell is, and it's men, but you could invert the genders and it would read the same. He has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, blah, 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 who have a husband, who are protected by law, and even with those who are already engaged. In other words, basically, you're having affairs with people, in effect. And whether or not you're married, you're doing it with people you shouldn't be doing it with. I think that's the idea. And I think that with regard to polyamory, For one, I think there's a question of, is there deception involved? And I think there are subtle forms of deception that are very interesting. Like, what are the consequences? You know, how's that working for you? If you're getting involved with somebody and you're clear that it's only going to go this far, and you can recognize over there that they hope and think there's a real good chance it'll go this far, particularly if they go to bed with you, and you don't disabuse them of that notion. You're not deceiving them. You're not leading them on. But you know that at the end of this road, they're going to experience a significant amount of pain. And is that ethical? I mean, you know, it's very interesting about the distinction between lying and not disclosing, and to what extent do we, as the Buddha says, give no one cause to fear us. In other words, you know, and it's a classic thing, how would you feel if that person did that to you? You know, so there, I think there are nuances and complexities of deception right off the top. You know, when we talk about the fourth precept, you know, don't speak falsely. Well, we speak in all kinds of ways, not just in our words, right? So that's one thing. The second thing I've personally seen is that I have seen polyamory work in the sense of people seem to be happy in it, and it seems to be stable and no less nutty than a typical monogamous marriage, right? No more nutty, no nuttier, you know, statistically, on the one hand. On the other hand, my personal observation of that world, which I've brushed up against pretty solidly on different times in my life, including with my clients, rarely have I seen it work. Usually it's just a mess. You know what I mean? And I think maybe one part of that's cultural and a lot of that's just people, but that's just personally what I've seen. If I could just offer this, and then maybe we'll sit for a moment and wrap up, and because I want to end on time and we're already a few minutes past 8:30. I think the real fundamental takeaway for each of us, that I would, I'll just offer this to you. You know, I'll say it like this. I try to reflect on to what end, right? In other words, the Dharma is really focused on processes and causes. So it's a continual focus on what are the results? You know, how's that working for you? Good or bad? To what end? And second, there is, I think, this place where, on the one hand, we have a healthy skepticism about our own mind. We sleep with the enemy every night, right between the ears. You know, this little guy, it's like worm tongue, right between our ears, whispering to us, it's all right, don't worry, it's a good idea, right? It seems like a really good idea at the time. Doesn't it do that? And I think it's really useful to have a very healthy skepticism about the tendencies of the mind to go after things, to fixate on them, and then pursue them in ways that lead to suffering, on the one hand, right? On the other hand, I just think that to comment on a quote, saying from a friend of mine once at a party at a Marin County white wine on the balcony and this lovely deck and Mill Valley kind of party, and he looked around and he said, wow, what a bunch of tame monkeys we all are. And what he meant by that was how, on the other hand, I think often we just needlessly live within small squares, you know? And in the bedroom and in the boardroom, we often needlessly live in small squares. And we flatten our own potential trajectory needlessly. And we do it out of another kind of enchantment. So to me, the art, of course, is to wake up from both kinds of enchantment. You know, the enchantment of getting fixated, and the way the brain and the mind tends to do that and then drives toward those pleasures and those rewards and gets organized around them. That's one kind of enchantment. But then there's the other kind of enchantment, like the tigers in the zoo that have lived behind iron bars their whole life. And then finally the iron bars are removed because they've built some kind of park they can go out in, and yet they never go past the painted lines on the ground. Right? Both are a form of enchantment. The trick, I think, is to be clear-eyed about each type of enchantment, because they both lead to suffering for ourselves and other people. So let's sit for a minute, let this digest, and then we'll talk more next time. May our sincere efforts this evening and at other times help free ourselves and others from suffering. Thank you for your practice. See you next week.